Welcome to episode 26. I'm Stuart McCullough. I'm the CEO of VHAA. And starting with this week's industrial roundup and with community health in particular, as we continue to work our way through 2017, which is an intensive year for bargaining for this particular group. The next key date for bargaining and community health is the 19th of July. On that day, we'll be utilising our regular monthly HRIR managers meeting to include CEOs as we discuss the responses to the items of claim. Prior to that time, our members are asked to return the survey that we've sent out. That survey has categorised the claims into a number of different categories, as well as providing some commentary and some recommendations to assist us to prepare a response to the various union claims and support bargaining. With respect to health services, we've had our rural and regional HR and IR managers meeting this week. For those rural and regional members who have not yet participated in one of our monthly meetings, they're always held on the second Wednesday of every month, utilising go-to meetings. With respect to the nurses agreement, we are getting consistent feedback that one of the key items for implementation concerns casual nurses and long service leave. We've provided to the ANMF a series of questions and a number of scenarios to support discussions between the parties with a view to trying to reach an agreed position. With respect to allied health professionals, we've provided VAHPA with a discussion paper with respect to the application of the higher qualifications provision. That discussion paper was developed with the support of the EBA reference group. What we would hope to do is reach an agreed position with that union and then distribute that guide for members to support the application of that clause. With respect to medical scientists, we are still consulting with the MSAV with regards to settling an implementation guide. We're also continuing work towards developing an EBA forum, and we'll be able to provide members with news of that EBA forum before too long. One last issue that we are quite mindful of. We do anticipate that there'll be much work to do in the second half of this year with respect to workplace bullying. We hope to have an announcement with regards to that before too long. And that's it for this week's Industrial Roundup. Welcome to the weekly update, where we go in depth with a particular subject. Joining me for this week's discussion is workplace relations consultant Emma Scott. Welcome, Emma.
Hi, Stuart. Thanks for having me.
Emma, would you be good enough to reveal the clue for this week's subject?
Yes, I can.
So, for the benefit of those people who are listening rather than watching this particular podcast, could you describe the object?
That's a placeholder carder for Tim.
For Tim Nagel?
Yes.
So I'm going to take that particular name tag and just pop it here. On the basis of that clue, what would you say this week's subject is?
I'm not sure.
A better guess might have been Tim, particularly given that he's not here this week. We could have talked about him behind his back. But the actual subject concerns independent contractors and employees and the fact that putting a particular label on an arrangement does not make it so.
So you're not Tim?
I am not Tim. Okay. And that is indeed the point of that particular example. We often get queries from members with regards to the difference between an independent contractor and an employee. And at the heart of that is ensuring that whatever the nature of the arrangement, that it accurately reflects the circumstances. Put simply, if you were to take an apple and call it an orange, it's not going to turn it into an orange. In the same way, by putting on a name badge that says Tim Nagel, doesn't turn me into Tim. So it's important that people be able to recognise the difference between those two types of arrangements.
So what is the difference between an independent contractor and employee?
Well, first of all, it's important to understand that significant things turn on that particular distinction. Members will be aware that we have a range of enterprise agreements that determine terms and conditions for employees. They don't apply to independent contractors. Also, legislation such as the Fair Work Act has a range of rights and protections that apply to employees that don't necessarily or don't particularly apply to independent contractors. A classic example of that would be the unfair dismissal provisions. They apply to those people who are employees, not to those who are independent contractors.
So, Stuart, what's the test for determining if a person is an employee or not under the Fair Work Act?
So notwithstanding that we're talking about the coverage of the Fair Work Act and whether someone's an employee under a piece of legislation, the test is actually a common law test.
So with the common law test, is there actually a decision of the Fair Work Commission that sums up the principles that you're talking about?
So there are lots of decisions on this issue, but perhaps the best decision for people to familiarise themselves with if they're looking for a good distillation of the relevant principles is a case called Jingxing Chao, trading as French Accent and De Rosario. That's a case that's known as simply as French Accent. And that contains a good summary of the relevant principles for distinguishing between an employee and independent contractor.
So bonjour.
Bonjour indeed.
If there is a dispute over an independent contractor or an employee, what occurs and how would the Fair Work Commission assist with that?
So what the Commission is trying to do in the event of a dispute of that nature is to determine the real substance of the relationship. In doing so, it's going to look at the totality of the circumstances in the relationship.
So when you're talking about substance, what happens if a contract actually just states that that person is an independent contractor? Does that mean that they are one?
So having a written contract that identifies someone as an independent contractor will be a relevant consideration, but by itself it won't be determinative. In the same way that we get back to that principle of wearing a name tag that doesn't suit won't have the effect of turning that thing into something that resembles the name tag. It's got to fit the circumstances. So a written contract is useful, is relevant, but it doesn't determine matters in their totality.
So given their commission is a third party, how do they go about actually working and sorting out through a dispute?
The way they do that is through a range of indicia, that is a range of indicators that help the commission to determine which characterisation best suits the circumstance.
So what are some examples of those?
The first of those is control. Control over how the work is performed, where the work is performed, the hours in which the work is performed. So control is a classic indicator that supports if a party can control all those things, that's more consistent with being an employment relationship. However, if it is that the work is done in a way that is controlled by the person performing it, done at a time of their choosing, then that might suggest an independent contractor arrangement.
So other than control, what are some of the other examples?
Whether or not the worker does work for other people.
Mm-hmm.
Because what we're trying to determine is whether the circumstances support a conclusion that what's happening is that the person who performs the work is in effect running their own business.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're trying to identify if we're looking for whether someone's an independent contractor. An independent contractor might well work for a range of employers or entities at once. That said, just a note of caution, the fact that a person works for more than one employer does not make them an independent contractor
mm-hmm.
as such. I think over time it's become more common for employees to hold more than one employment contract.
Mm-hmm.
So for those people who identify that fact, it doesn't mean you can then categorise an employee as an independent contractor.
So Stuart, is what the worker tells the world at large important?
It's also relevant. So the way that a worker actually presents themselves to others could indicate one way or another the nature of the relationship. If, for example, the worker has their own workshop and mm-hmm. performs the work there, if they have a website or a Facebook page that represents that they're running their own business, those are things that might support a conclusion that an independent contractor arrangement exists.
So what's another indicator?
Another indicator, another example would include whether or not the worker supplies their own tools and equipment. Supplying their own tools and equipment is consistent with being an independent contractor. Conversely, having the tools and equipment supplied for you by the entity that's engaging you to perform the work is more consistent with an employment relationship.
So what about the termination of the arrangement?
So in terms of terminating an arrangement, employers terminate the employment of an employee, but entities can terminate a contract, and that's a slightly different thing.
So how is it different?
I guess in two respects, one of which is that there may be certain protections in the case of termination of employment.
Mm-hmm.
In the context, though, of the termination of a contract for services, generally you're doing so on the basis of the particular contract or upon the completion of a service, you're simply not entering into another contract.
So you're talking about how the worker at large represents themselves. What about the importance of how the entity represents?
Also really significant. The way in which the entity engages with the person doing the work is a fundamentally relevant consideration. If, for example, a person who is performing work is signing in as a contractor, wearing a badge that identifies them as a contractor, those are things that are all supportive of it being an independent contractor arrangement. Conversely, if someone is being told that they're an independent contractor but is required to go through all the steps that you go through if you're an employee, then that's fundamentally at odds with that conclusion.
So what about income tax?
It can also be relevant. Employers will deduct income tax on behalf of their employees. That won't be the case in terms of an invoice. But there may be goods and services tax that applies to the amount that's being invoiced.
And what about another item that usually applies to employees, superannuation?
Well, this is a point for caution in the sense that we've been talking about the fact that to determine whether someone's an employee under the Fair Work Act, it's a common law test. Superannuation legislation has a definition for employee that is in fact broader than the common law test. It's a beneficial provision. So somebody may well be entitled to superannuation payments, notwithstanding the fact that they're an independent contractor, because the test is beneficial and broader.
So that makes it seem a lot more complex.
It is complex, and I think for those people who enter into an independent contractor arrangement, thinking that they don't have an obligation to pay superannuation should really get some advice on that point.
What about how they would normally pay the arrangement and how that affects it?
In terms of how they would ordinarily pay the arrangement, what, for superannuation or...?
Just normal hourly rate or...?
In terms of that format, I guess employment is perhaps marked by the fact that you are paid for hours worked, as opposed to being paid for a particular service, mm-hmm. which is more in line with an independent contractor arrangement.
Mm-hmm. What about annual leave or sick leave?
Again, classic entitlements of employment, not so with independent contractor arrangements.
Are there any other things that are consistent with being a contractor versus an employee?
Well, coming back to that issue of what we're trying to determine is if someone is being identified as an independent contractor, identifying whether in effect they're running, in a practical sense, their own business. If the work that that person is doing is building up value in a business, then that is something that supports a conclusion of independent contractor.
So the examples that you've given, are they exhaustive?
No, they're not. So they're indicative only, mm-hmm. and the decisions make it clear that they're not exhaustive.
So we've talked about a range of indicators. Are they what's used in the Commission to determine those outcomes, every single one of those?
So it's not a case that you need to satisfy all of those indicators in one direction or another. The indicators are really are exactly that. They're a tool that gives an indication to help the Commission determine on balance what is the appropriate characterisation of the arrangement.
So Stuart, to be an independent contractor, do all of those indicators that you've gone through have to be in the positive to be determined as an independent contractor?
No, look, the indicia are exactly that. They are indicators only. They're a means by which to determine on balance what the best characterisation for a particular relationship is, as to whether or not a person is in an employment relationship with all the features of control and the like, or whether or not they are in effect running their own business.
So it sounds like a tough job to decide.
Effectively what a commission will do is make determinations with regards to a range of indicia, perhaps as a tool to weigh up a conclusion or reach a conclusion. There are instances that I've seen where members of the commission have even included a table and outline whether or not it weighs in favour of a conclusion of contractor or employee, or sometimes even whether a particular indicator does not give an indication. That is, it's just a neutral consideration.
Mm-hmm. So you sound like you know a lot, obviously, from all of these questions that I've been asking you. What are some important tips you might give to some of our members?
So I think there are two key things that members should be mindful of. And the first of those things is that the arrangement must suit the circumstance. There is no value in calling someone an independent contractor if that's not the way in which the arrangement actually functions. Similarly, an employment relationship is perhaps the most standard way of engaging and obtaining services within health services. So I would certainly recommend that people exercise a great degree of caution if they're looking to characterise something other than an employment relationship, that is, as an independent contractor.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing is, if people are creating an independent contractor arrangement, to take great care in the way in which they record that arrangement. The number of times that we get a query about that and somebody sends through a document for our review, and the document then is often an employment contract that's been modified to create an independent contractor arrangement, and often uses the term employment, mm-hmm. and has a lot of features of the employment.
Yep.
So I think it's not just in terms of the way in which it practically operates, it must be consistent with the label, but it must also be the case that in creating the arrangement, that you are actively considering why it is that you're seeking to create an independent contractor arrangement, and that the written documents support that. So those are some of the key tips with regards to that determination between independent contractor and employee. Thanks for taking the time today, Emma, to go through it.
Thanks, Tim.